I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, are we doomed? The great climate change debate. After hearing a previous edition of Parallax Views, in which I had a conversation with Patrick Farnsworth of the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast on the topic of climate change, and whether we could weather the storm of climate catastrophe in the future, listener Alexander Miller contacted me asking to debate the issue of whether or not we are doomed by climate change. Alexander informed me that he had spoken on this very topic for the podcast You Can't Win. I gave that episode a listen, got back in contact with Alexander, then I reached out to Patrick Farnsworth, and I brought us all together for a debate on the issue of climate change, whether it spells certain doom for all in the future. And now, without further ado, the great debate. Welcome to Parallax Views for the climate doomerism debate. It's the debate of the century, folks. Patrick Farnsworth of the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast and Alexander Miller, who recently challenged climate doomerism on the excellent You Can't Win podcast. How's everyone doing tonight?
Great, great. How about yourself?
Pretty good, pretty good.
Yeah, I'm doing really well. Yeah, I'm pretty relaxed. I feel like I'm almost too relaxed to be having a debate right now, but I'll do my best to keep up.
Well, debate, discussion, it could be either of those. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're sharing our perspectives.
Yes, that's a great way to say it.
Well, I'm going to let you guys start out. Maybe Alexander, since you haven't been on the podcast before, you could introduce yourself first and your viewpoint in this discussion.
Okay. As you said, you might have heard me on You Can't Win if you ever listened to that. I want to say first off that I'm not a climate scientist. I'm not an expert of any kind, really. I kind of think of myself as an informed layman. I read all the IPCC reports. I read a lot of other articles in journals about climate change and try to really dig into the science on these issues. But, you know, I'm certain I'll make plenty of mistakes, and you shouldn't take my word for anything. But at the same time, I think that, you know, I compared to what you will hear from a lot of journalists and commentators on this stuff, I'm more grounded in the science. And my perspective is that I listened to the earlier episode with Patrick, and I think that he is a little too far or going a little too hard on the doom stuff. I think that climate change is a very, very serious issue, but we also shouldn't get carried away. I think that we should be looking at exactly what we can expect out of this and how that's going to play out. And I think that it's, you know, there are plenty of threats that we're facing from climate change, but probably the end of civilization and, you know, the people on this podcast dying are not in the cards.
Can I clarify something with you, Alexander? What do you think the effects of climate change will be? I know there's a lot of talk about that this is going to affect the poor in the third world first and probably hardest. Is that sort of your take?
Well, I think it. Here's the question. We often talk about an existential threat. I think that climate change is an existential threat to you if you are already one of the most vulnerable people on Earth. If you're already very poor, you don't have access to modern technology, and you are, you know, a subsistence farmer. You know, if you're living in the African Sahel, if you are living in rural India, it is absolutely an existential threat to you. Whereas more advanced countries, and, you know, these countries can move up over the century that climate change is going to play out, there is much less of a threat there. It's going to be geographically distributed as well. You know, if you live in southern Florida, I think there's a very good chance that you're going to have to move. And if you live in Bangladesh, there's a very good chance that you're going to become a refugee. However, these things are going to be unevenly distributed, both by basically income, you know, by how wealthy you are, and also just geographically, kind of not randomly distributed, but geographically distributed.
Okay. And now I want to kick it over to Patrick. For listeners that didn't get a chance to hear our prior conversation, Patrick, maybe you could introduce yourself and your viewpoint on the issue of climate change and the environment.
Okay. I've been on your show before, JG, and I guess, you know, I mean, I have a shtick, you know, I will say, so I think when it comes to talking about climate change, I mean, I've looked at it in, you know, I know that we talked about this a little bit before the recording of this, this thing here, but you know, Alex, you were kind of maybe contending with some of the idea that there's exponential change here. I tend to think that that is the case, based on the data that at least I've looked at. We are looking at least several degrees of warming within probably this century, most likely. We're already well above 1.2, even to 1.5°C above pre-industrial baseline temperatures. And that's within, obviously, the past couple centuries. And we've seen much of that warming within a shorter period of time. So when you look at, like, general temperature rise globally, based on the data that's been gathered, we are seeing something like an exponential shift here. So how that exponential shift is going to play out is nonlinear. I do think that often when you get into the IPCC or these, you know, government bodies of scientists, it's not that the data they're using is wrong. That's not it at all. What I've been pointed to, at least in my work, is that often these large groups of scientists that we see with the UN, for instance, from various nations around the world, I mean, this is a very politicized group. It's very well known that, for instance, if you have a nation like the United States, they don't like certain types of data to be maybe represented in that. They will work to, or lobby, I guess. I don't know how you'd say that, but they work to kind of maybe downplay some of the things or to remove certain types of data or projections within those reports. Also, the most recent IPCC report that came out, I guess, last year, they were basically working with the data that is probably at least 5 to 10 years old. There's a lot more recent data that's come out. So basically what I'm trying to say is people use the IPCC as the benchmark. And I think often these reports, this is science by consensus. This is, again, it's safe. It's easy to look at it. But in a general sense, they're underplaying the issue. And also, when they do talk about projections, they're often excluding specific things like feedback loops. So there is a lot of projection. There is a lot of thinking that I think lends itself to maybe exaggeration or, you know, more doomer type mentalities, more stark or more dire implications, right? And I acknowledge if people want to be skeptical of that, that's probably a safe bet. But I think we can kind of just look around in the world today, and we're already seeing the impacts of abrupt climate disruption. And we're one of the things also that scientists point to is that there's about a 30-year lag when it comes to heating. So the climate change that we're experiencing today, the level of warming that we're at right now, is from carbon emissions that came from about 30 years ago. And we've been emitting more carbon by the year almost, by the year we're emitting more carbon pretty much than the year previous. So we can kind of make the assumption, I suppose, and again, this is an assumption and I totally recognize I'm biased in this. I have to be very clear that I also, as Alex said, you know, he's not a scientist, he's a layman. Same thing goes for myself. I am just a very curious person trying to present my perspective on this. But from all the scientists that I've talked to and the journalists that have been covering this subject, they're very concerned because we are seeing really dramatic and rapid change in specific areas of the planet, like the Arctic is one really, really big example of rapid change. It's the canary in the coal mine, as they say. When you have the permafrost thawing at an accelerating rate, when you have more and more methane being released from these areas, causing something like 100 times the warming of carbon in a 100-year time scale, when you have the Arctic sea ice disappearing, it'd probably be what's called a blue ocean event, in which there'll be no Arctic sea ice cover in the summertime in the Arctic region, probably within, again, projections. But based on the trends that we're seeing today, we may not have Arctic sea ice cover within the next 5 years. You calculate all these things. You start to recognize how much heating that's going to cause, how much that's going to be baked into the global climate system and into the oceans. You have to really start ask the questions, well, what are the global implications of this? How does this impact weather patterns, jet streams? How does this impact ocean currents? What does that mean for food production? And you fit that within a larger perspective of how our societies are structured, the global economic system, the way nation states work, borders. I mean, you fit that within the whole socioeconomic and political systems that we're a part of. It's really not that difficult to imagine chaos and, you know, collapse and rising authoritarianism as a response. I mean, all of these things are interplaying with each other. And so for me, I don't have the most optimistic view of the future. And, you know, I would even extend that far enough as to say that it's going to be very difficult for human beings to survive on a planet that's anywhere from 3 to 5 to even 8 degrees warmer than it was before the Industrial Revolution began. That's my essential premise with my work.
And I want to ask you, since I asked Alexander, do you think that this is going to affect the most vulnerable populations first and probably hardest in a lot of ways? Because that's, I mean, I'll be honest, that's basically my contention and what I've got from speaking to a lot of climate justice activists. And I think it gets lost in the conversation about climate change a lot of times.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely think that's the case. That's. I mean, every place is going to be impacted. It's not like any place is going to be able to escape the impacts of climate disruption. But we do need to acknowledge that the places that are the least equipped to deal with, say, sea level rise tend to be small island nations and wherever they're at. And also places like Bangladesh. I mean, I was going to cite this later if it ever came up, but there was a report that the U.S. military commission just, I think it was maybe this year or last year, but they had released it very recently. And it's basically them looking at the next 20 years, and they're seeing that within that time frame, we're looking at Bangladesh, because it's below sea level. Much of it is below sea level. They're expecting tens of millions of people to be displaced from just that nation alone. And this is, again, what we would call a third world, or I hate using these terms because it's loaded with all of these, you know, I think implications, but we know what we're talking about when we say it. These are less developed nation states. So you have Bangladesh experiencing radical sea level rise, which is going to inundate most of the nation. That's the fucked up thing here. Most of Bangladesh will be underwater within the century, most definitely. You imagine what that means. That's tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people that are displaced, moving into neighboring nations. What does that mean? You know, and so, yes, absolutely. That's just one example. But we're looking at, I think, the most dire implications of climate disruption being in much poorer regions of the world. Yeah.
And I absolutely agree with that, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
This is sort of a little bit of a sort of side issue to the question of doomerism, but I think the one thing that I've been most uncomfortable with when it comes to what's been referred to as doomerism, and this also is true of when the peak oil debate was still a big thing in a lot of online philosophical and political discussions, it seems like at times there's a sort of biblical justice mentality to a lot of doomerism. And I don't think you're guilty of that, Patrick, but I've noticed some people think like, well, this is just this. It's almost like they want, you know, a catastrophe to happen. Like humanity deserves this kind of thing. Right. Or at least that's what I've seen in some circles, a sort of biblical justice. This is what we deserve. Sort of apocalypse mentality.
Yeah, and if I could...
Absolutely.
Sorry, Alex, you go on. I'll just...
Oh, well, that just kind of reminds me of a book by Daniel Quinn, Ishmael, which is one of... He's an anarcho-primitivist, and the book is kind of... It was my first introduction to that idea, and he has this idea of the civilizational myth. And what he says is that modern society's civilizational myth is of progress. We go up and up and up and up, up. And but at the end, everybody has this idea that this can't go on. It has to come to an end. We're going too far. And it's all going to come tumbling down. And his idea, you know, I think it's actually kind of interesting coming from a guy who I would definitely call a doomer, that he kind of integrates that into his idea that, you know, this is a collective thing. Everybody already realizes that society deserves what's coming to it. You know, we've polluted the world, we've caused all sorts of misery, and we're kind of going to get what we deserve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's something that I've tried to, I guess, in my own way, push back against in what I would call it the doomer community or the, I mean, there's all kinds of these groups online that I am associated with, honestly, but these people that are near-term human extinction groups, right? So they are very much in that doomer camp. But there is something I get a lot of and I see a lot of, which I do not endorse and I actually push back against in my own way, which is that this idea that human beings have it coming to them, that the people, that there's too many people on the planet, we're like a virus or a scourge, and that there's this kind of biblical justice or karmic justice, retribution.
Yeah, bacteria in a petri dish.
Exactly. And I don't agree with that. You know, I think, yeah, we have, you know, come up against obvious limits, and that applies to any species, any organism on the planet. We're not an exception to the rule by any means, but I'm not happy. Like, people take this kind of sick, almost sadistic, and it's actually masochistic because we're all humans and we're all going to die, you know what I mean, from this anyway. So it's sort of a sadistic / masochistic thing where they take a certain joy in knowing, like, oh, you know, all of these stupid humans are going to disappear. Our intelligence, our so-called cleverness is going to kill us in the end. And I'm not here to say, like, I'm definitely don't believe that. I'm not rooting for the extinction of the human species. That's not what I'm trying to promote. I think human beings actually have a really necessary and right role, if done correctly, within the broader life systems of the planet. We actually have a place within it. But when we get off on the wrong path, which I think our civilization, the trajectory it's been down, has produced that crisis. So I just like to point that out to people. Like, look, there's many, many, many examples of human societies, of groups of human beings that have known how to live within balance in their various, their respective ecosystems, bioregions, and what have you. We certainly don't, as we are today within the so-called developed world, the industrialized global north particularly. So I'm more angry and more upset and really want to contend with the various systems that produce this crisis to begin with. So when JG talks about, you know, how climate change is going to impact the people in the poorest regions of the world, these are not the people that are responsible for climate change. They are absolutely not. They have the smallest carbon footprint in the world. It's us. It's the consumers up here in the global north. We're the ones that are doing most of this. And it's not even just us.
It depends where you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Because obviously China has a – people there are not quite as rich as we are, but they're also the largest carbon emitter on the planet. And they're per capita, it's about the same as Europe.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and then even to make it even more specific, I mean, something, I can't remember what the statistic is. I'm forgetting all these numbers. Again, I'm not a scientist. It should be obvious right. that I'm not. But there's like a really high percentage of the carbon that's emitted comes from specifically from the U.S. military, from the military industrial complex and all the, you know, all of the components of that. I mean, it's like something like 40.
It is large, but you have to put that in perspective, too.
What's the perspective of that, though?
I mean, the entire U.S., military or anything else, is about 12% of carbon emissions. So, you know, it's I actually, when you read these articles about the U.S. military being a huge carbon emitter, it's never quantified. And my guess is that it's a very small percentage of the total, you know, less than 1%. I don't actually know the numbers offhand because they never say them. And, you know, why aren't they saying them? You know, it is, I'm certain it is the largest single carbon emitter, but, you know, that's because there are hundreds of or thousands of companies that are huge carbon emitters. And if you put, and when it comes to, you know, the U.S. military is the biggest, you know, company, for lack of a better word, in the world, and they're a big carbon emitter. I mean, the way that I see this is it's really a global problem. You know, I think that what you're saying has a lot to it. You know, if you're talking about the absolute poorest people in the world who are, you know, an African sorghum farmer basically emits almost no carbon. But there is also a sliding scale, especially as the third world or the developing world continues to industrialize. People in China and India are getting air conditioners. They're getting more access to electricity. They're moving to the cities and they're getting jobs in factories and people are the gap is narrowing, basically. You know, that's not true everywhere. You know, it's obvious, it's distributed unevenly, but it's not so simple anymore. Like the U.S. and including its military and the EU combined emit more carbon, emit less carbon than China alone. And even if you account for the imports, you know, like China produces a lot of goods that are imported into the U.S. and Europe, the picture doesn't change much. You know, it's that this is one of the things I get on about a lot because, you know, people will say kind of what you just said, you know, it's the industrialized world. Well, you know, the industrialized world is only emitting 25% of the carbon now. It is really a global problem. And so this complicates things, not just in terms of, you know, who's to blame, but also the reason or the reason that China and India are emitting more carbon is because their people are getting richer and they are getting out of this, you know, dead end of being subsistence farmers, and they're getting better jobs. You know, they're certainly not as good as the jobs you can get here. You know, and they're moving towards a better future. So it's kind of a double bind. You know, you are on the one hand emitting more carbon, which is going to hurt us down the road, but you are also, you know, lifting people out of poverty. You know, I'm not saying that the way that China and India do that is the best way or the way that I would choose, but it really does complicate the issue. Because we have to balance this need to drag people out of this kind of you know, backwardsness, for lack of a better word, into with the needs that we have for climate, with the needs we have for limiting carbon emissions.
Well, I do want to push back against, I mean, I can't rate or give you percentages of, as far as the U.S. military and how much carbon it emits relative, but I just had an interview with a man named Oliver Belcher, who teaches at, he's an assistant professor in geography at Durham University, and he did a study with two other individuals, and they came out with a study. I think the study was titled, it's like Hidden Carbon Costs of the Everywhere War, Logistics, Geopolitical Ecology, and the Carbon Bootprint of the U.S. Military. So in the article that they published for the conversation, it's reading it right now. It says, if the U.S. military were a country, its fuel usage alone would make it the 47th largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, sitting between Peru and Portugal. So that's, again, I can't...
That's very low, that. I mean, Peru and Portugal are quite small countries.
Right. I understand that point. I do think it's important to acknowledge, though, that, and this is the other part of this article that they point to. Often, and this kind of points to some of the issues with the data. And again, this may actually shoot me in the foot. We talk about data and what's included or excluded from it. But another part of this article states that often the U.S. military emissions are excluded or overlooked in climate change studies because, for instance, in the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, the United States insisted on having military emissions exempted from that. There was a loophole that was closed in the Paris Accord, and of course then the Trump administration withdrew from that accord, which will happen in next year. So anyway, my point is it's really hard sometimes to know. And I think part of what this researcher was pointing to in his work is that you're looking at, you know, not just the amount of barrels of oil that are used, but also the infrastructure. I mean, the United States has hundreds of military bases around the world that has to be maintained, includes building roads, and all the other things that come with maintaining a global military empire. So I think there is a lot of room here. I can't argue against you completely. But I do just want to make this really this point, which is that I think that when it comes to global carbon emissions, there's a lot of things that are not included in that. And I think much of the problem can be attributed to, and look, I mean, we could throw China in there, too. I mean, whether China emits more carbon than the United States or not, I really don't care. They're both highly industrialized nation states, and they have been working very hard to maintain that. And with China particularly, because they're like, we want to be one of the wealthiest and most powerful economic states in the world, of course they're going to do whatever they can to get there. So, you know, if that means they're going to extract as much coal and emit as much carbon as possible to get there, they're going to do it. And so I don't know what my point is, except just to say that it is a global issue. It's absolutely a global issue. But just like with anything, there are specific groups of people that are more responsible for it than others. And so it's unfortunate in this really shitty situation we're all in collectively that the poorest among us tend to be the most deeply impacted and are the first to be impacted by climate disruption. And I mean, this includes indigenous people, whether they're in, for instance, defending the forests and in the Amazon, or it's the people up in the global north, all the way up in the Arctic. You know, they're contending with melting or thawing permafrost, and now that's, you know, receding coastlines. I mean, it's one thing right after the other. We're seeing, again, some of the most the poorest among us that tend to be the first affected by this.
Absolutely. I do kind of want to go full circle here, and I'll try to link this into what you said too, but I want to go full circle to what you said initially. And just to briefly respond to whether we're including all the carbon. I mean, you know, we measure this stuff. Like, there is an observatory at Mauna Loa, which has been measuring the amount of carbon in the atmosphere since, I believe it's 1955. It's the baseline because it's been doing it the longest. And we have all sorts of other methods. We have use satellites as well as aircraft to measure how much carbon is coming out of a particular area. And I think that we have actually a very good idea of how much carbon is being emitted. Mm-hmm. And to work that in to what you said initially, I think that your understanding of the science is flawed. We talked about this before the show, but I just want to introduce this view, which is how I think that the activist or environmentalist view of climate change or the doomerist view, whatever it may be, doesn't match up with the science. What you get from mainstream climate scientists that work with the IPCC is that climate change is linear. The more carbon we emit, the more warming we get. If we stop emitting carbon, the Earth stops warming. Mm-hmm. And the way that what most activists will say is something like what you said, which is that, you know, as, you know, we're already keyed in for, you know, much more warming than, you know, mainstream climate scientists will tell you we're actually keyed in for. If you go to the latest IPCC report, you know, it's right there on the second page. It says if we stopped emitting carbon right now, the Earth wouldn't warm anymore. And if you go to the section, which is actually about, you know, how we know this, I believe it's chapter two, but I can't remember offhand. It might be chapter three. I can't remember. But they say, you know, there was this idea that there was committed warming. There was this idea that there was committed warming because the seas had not balanced out with the warming we have in the atmosphere. They had not warmed as much. And so there will be more warming as we go on. But what they say is, well, also the amount of carbon in the atmosphere is going to go down if we stop emitting it. You know, we've always heard, you know, carbon will stick around for hundreds of thousands of years, but that's not quite true. There are multiple mechanisms that remove carbon from the atmosphere. The thousands of years stuff is that it gets absorbed by rocks, basically. It's called chemical weathering. Mm-hmm. But within a period of decades, 50% of the carbon will be gone. Within a couple centuries, 80% will be gone. And within a couple of millennia, 90% will be gone. And only that 10% is going to be there for tens or hundreds of thousands of years. So there's also this idea that, you know, climate scientists don't consider feedbacks, which is just ridiculous. I don't know why this line keeps coming up again and again. The whole thing is about feedbacks. You know, if we didn't include feedbacks, we would say that the carbon emissions are only going to raise the temperature by about 1 degree. If you doubled the amount of carbon emission, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, you know, and you talked about Arctic sea ice, you know, if we lose Arctic sea ice, you know, that's going to raise the temperature, which is absolutely true. It's called surface albedo, and it's basically have snow on the ground. It's white and it reflects light back into the atmosphere, and we get less warming. That is already included in any climate model you've ever seen. And as far as we know, all of the significant feedbacks are included in those models. The one that also comes up very frequently is permafrost, which, you know, we have not found a way to include in models, but we have estimated it. And, you know, even on the high end, even if you are a pessimist on permafrost, the amount of warming that is going to give us is a small fraction of the amount that our carbon emissions are going to cause. It might be 5% more, it might be 12% more, but it would not be enough to challenge this longstanding understanding of linear climate change.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I I'm trying to think exactly what to say to that. Well, I would say with the methane thing, I think the issue is that methane has several. What's it like? It's always different. I always hear a different statistic, but it's like up to 100 times the warming effect. And of course, it's usually short-lived in the atmosphere. It does dissipate. But if you have large amounts of methane released all at once, and this is really, again, this is a fear. Take it for what it is, but we're already seeing this happening right now. There's like a subsea methane hydrates in Siberia. Mm-hmm. So in the very shallow seabed, right, you have large deposits of methane. Now, these are already starting to release. They've already seen large plumes, basically, of methane that are starting to bubble up through this. Methane can have a significant effect on warming. again, I can't maybe point to exactly the amount, so maybe I am overblowing it a bit. But the issue is that you have multiple feedback loops that are kind of reinforcing themselves. So yeah, they do include feedback loops into their equations, of course. I think the issue is that you have, you were talking about carbon being sequestered. Much of the carbon sinks that we have, I think, have been really radically diminished. And I think this is why the crisis runs far deeper than just climate change itself or anthropogenic climate change. And if we don't have enough forests, for instance, to sequester much of that carbon, like, for instance, they've actually seen a trend of forests emitting carbon versus sequestering carbon. It's like doing the opposite of what it used to do. And this is a pretty rapid trend as well. So, and again, if you have this rapid rate of deforestation, again, if we stop deforestation right now and we let all the forests regenerate on their own, like, sure, we could maybe mitigate a lot of this. And part of my pessimism comes from a sense that I don't think that we're going to see corporations and governments reversing these trends, where you have the Amazon, for instance, where they're just burning down the forest. So not only is that releasing carbon, but whatever sort of sequestration that the Amazon forest would have is just being completely obliterated, and it's being turned into something that actually emits carbon, which is cattle ranches and soy farms. So again, I can't argue every point of yours. Again, I will not say that I can, but I do think that what the issue is with feedback loops in particular, it is a compounding effect. And I think also some of the pessimism I have is I'm already starting to see presently some of the impacts that the that climate disruption is already having on, say, food production. So when we saw what happened in the Midwest this spring, that is a result of climate disruption. And something that, again, that people have a real fear of is like, okay, this happened this year. Now, maybe next year it won't happen. Maybe next year the farmers will be able to farm their crops at the right time and get on schedule again. But if you have this happening even within every 5 years from each other, this is unsustainable operation at this point. So that's really kind of a big part of it as well, is just sort of anticipating climate disruption in the way that human systems are going to be able to adapt to those changes. So maybe it won't warm nearly as much as I think it will. Maybe we won't enter into a hot state, as some scientists have pointed to. But nonetheless, the climate disruption will be so, I think, so dramatic that it's really hard to imagine people adapting, I think, to those changes and mass migrations and food production and all of those things are going to be really detrimentally impacted by, I think, some of these changes. And they already are currently. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because this points to another point that I like to bring up again, in these discussions, which is, yeah, I suppose it is hard to imagine adapting to these changes, but that's kind of what society does, or civilization does, or capitalism does. We've adapted to live in, every climate that exists on Earth. We've massively transformed the climate already and our landscapes by creating farms, and by what we're doing right now, which is changing the climate. And it doesn't really strike me as, I don't find this argument convincing. There's, there's been all these predictions throughout history that say, there's no way capitalism can survive this. There's no way society can survive this. And it just rolls right over those. Like, this goes, for example, these kind of environmental predictions have been going on for a very, very long time. They've been going on, longer than my age and your age combined. One that I always like to talk about is Paul Ehrlich, who wrote a book called The Population Bomb. And he predicted in, I believe it was the late 60s. It was the late 60s. It may have been 68. Very pretentious year. That in the coming decades, the Earth would begin to experience massive famines because population was going to outstrip our ability to produce food. And he was not the only person saying this. He was not even the first person to say this, but it became incredibly popular. it was a big hit, and you know, you had people going around saying, you know,
can I add something to that real quick?
Yeah, go right ahead.
I was gonna say it's interesting. Ehrlich is still really popular with a lot of
extremely
reactionary thinkers like Steve Saylor. Yeah,
I'm gonna let you go on. I just want to add, there was a recent climate petition. It says it's 11,000 climate scientists say we have to deal with climate change, something like that, and. It starts out saying, you know, we have to control population, and it's this big thing. You'll see plenty of articles about it. And you scroll down to the bottom, and right there is Paul Ehrlich. He's one of the editors or contributors or something like that. This guy keeps coming up again and again, even though he's been so wrong. Anyway, go on.
Well, I will say, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think the issue with him, it wasn't that he was wrong in saying that we would run out of resources and have famines. It's the fact that that was right when they had the Green Revolution. Is that right? I mean, that was right when we started to see them, you know, they completely revolutionized how agricultural production was done, you know, involved, you know, production of fertilizer, and various ways to kind of genetically modify food. I mean, there was a pretty dramatic shift in how agriculture was done at that time. So there's always these things. I mean, there's always these like anticipated collapses or like you said, you know, they end up not really coming up because there's always some clever, you know, fix that comes in at some point or another. And I guess for me, this is true. I mean, obviously there's always going to be some clever person or group of people that are going to come up with some invention to try to stave off something that is, I think, kind of inevitable. So for instance, if there was a Green Revolution, right, what they call the Green Revolution, where they started implementing, you know, really intensive agricultural practices involving pesticides and herbicides. I mean, just again, you know, this isn't related to climate change specifically, but this is, I think, tied to the root cause of climate change, which is our attempts to, you know, industrialization and maximizing control over the earth and the systems of the earth in order to meet some sort of, you know, profit motive, essentially, within a capitalist paradigm. So you have, for instance, a situation in which they start to use intensive amounts of chemicals to produce food for larger groups of larger populations. I mean, and now we're seeing something like 40% or more of insects worldwide have just disappeared. Some places it's up to 80% of insects have completely disappeared. I mean, this is just, you know, standard research that they're doing in various regions
even
around the planet.
Than that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I just don't see any reason why that's going to come to an end. But JJ, do you have something to say about Paul Ehrlich?
Yeah. Well, it's just very interesting to me. There's a lot of like, I would go further than just reactionaries, but there's been white nationalists who have taken a strong interest in his work over the years, especially people like Steve Saylor. And maybe this ties into something we can talk about a little bit later, and that's sort of the rise of eco-fascism. I still think it's a very fringe sort of thing, but it is worrying in a lot of ways. I guess Ehrlich, to me, has always come off as uncomfortably neo-Malthusian.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed him once, actually.
Oh, really? What was your impression of him?
Oh, I had like a half an hour with him. It was, you know, it was good. It was doomy, as you would expect, but it was, I can't even remember it. It's probably like 2 years ago, but yeah. Anyway, I interrupted Alex. I'm sorry.
Oh, no worries. I mean, well, I was just going to say that he's like the paradigm neo-Malthusian. He's sort of not the founder, but the poster boy for it.
You know who's a big one now, actually, and he probably makes me even more uncomfortable because I'm not as familiar with what Ehrlich has been saying lately, but Sir David Atten, I'm blanking on his name.
Attenborough,
yes, yeah, Sir David Attenborough. He was, he keeps writing these articles where he's, you know, saying how overpopulation is a huge problem, but he's always pointing towards, you know, he's sort of saying, like, these third world people need to breed less. And I just think there's something really uncomfortable about that. And I don't think ultimately, I don't think the Neo-Malthusian viewpoint is correct. You know, every sociologist I've spoken to and people within the social sciences say we have the resources to feed most of the world. That's just my sort of take, though.
And this goes into what we were saying before, which is that those people that are supposedly breeding too much, those are precisely the people that are emitting the least carbon. Mm-hmm. So that's not the problem. The problem, as far as carbon emissions go, is industry. Mm-hmm. And wealth in a certain sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also there's something else that needs to be addressed, which is, you know, I mentioned insect population decline, and that's really not as much about climate change as it is about agricultural practices, right? And also deforestation, things like this, right? Climate change is, I think, a symptom of a deeper problem, which is something I try to accentuate in my own way. Because, you know, let's say that climate change isn't really as big of a deal as I maybe think it is, right? What if it doesn't warm as much as I think? What if I'm just overplaying this overblown nonsense? You know, what if that's true? Again, that doesn't change the fact that we're seeing pretty much all of the forests and other wild, or whatever we can call wild, but you know, all these places in the world are just being converted into basically farms to serve, you know, these giant, you know, cattle operations, and you have, you know, the fish in the oceans are just being completely decimated and just over extracted. You know, insects, again, they're disappearing. You know, world wildlife populations, I think it's something like over 60% or something of them have disappeared in the past just several decades. I mean, like, regardless of whether global climate change is as big a threat as I think it is or not, our civilization and our whole economic social paradigm is, I think, killing the planet. Whatever living planet we have is being thoroughly fractured, fragmented, and destroyed in order to serve this really just idiotic notion of profit. It doesn't make any sense. It's the most idiotic thing that any species could ever pursue, and we're doing it without unrelentingly. So for me, you know, the climate change is an existential threat in the sense that it's like, regardless of whether it leads to our extinction or not, it is one of several things that's pointing to something deeply unhealthy about the way human beings, particularly industrialized human beings, are conducting their lives right now on a mass scale. And so for me, climate change is a tool to explain, like, look, this is an obvious example of why our way of living on this planet is deeply just wrong. It's unhealthy. It violates other living things. And this is why we have to do this. Why we have to change it. Yeah.
I have a lot of sympathy for that, by the way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, of course.
I would push back in some respects. You know, U.S. farmland peaked in about a century ago, and global farmland peaked mid-century. So it's not as though the farmlands are expanding. They're expanding in certain places and they're contracting in others.
Mm.
But at the same time, I absolutely agree with what you said as to the question of whether there is a larger problem. And I think that's absolutely true. There is a larger problem. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, I think that the ecological perspective can shed a lot of light on that. What I tend to disagree with is the idea that we have to step back and, you know, give up our dreams of wealth and give up technology and so on and become take our natural place in the world. It seems to me that humans' natural place in the world has to just be something that's like modern life, but is able to respect the rest of nature, that is able to, you know, do something beneficial for it or at least preserve it. And I think that is absolutely possible within, you know, the existing paradigm. I'm certainly pessimistic about actually doing that. It would take, you know, I don't really see how you could. But
Well, I mean,
we should absolutely be advocating for it regardless.
Right. So when you say that we can do it within our current paradigm, I mean, what are you referring to? Kind of infinite. What I call it the infinite growth paradigm, which is to say that we live in a it's a version of capitalism. Some people get really touchy about it because I don't know why, but basically we live in a global capitalist system which requires growth. It's a growth model. You know, you need to make more GDP has to increase in order for it to be working.
Endless
growth. So that means that there has to be something converted into capital endlessly. So at a certain point, I mean, that's why I think that's why things are getting so weird. I know that sounds strange, but what I mean by that is capitalists have to find more and more things to convert into capital. So that could be something as material as fossil fuels, land, forests, whatever. Or it could be something as ephemeral or as sort of abstract as your attention, as your ideas, as your identity. Which is what we see now with the internet and social media and all of these new technologies that have emerged over the past several decades. More and more things have to be converted into capital. And this is just the trend that we have seen emerge particularly out of Europe since the medieval, you know, into the Enlightenment era when capitalism emerged. That's what happened. You started to see the enclosures, the land enclosures. You started to see colonization, the slave trade, like all of these things. They may not have called it capitalism, but it laid the groundwork for capitalism to emerge. So when I see this ecological crisis and climate change, I see this as the end point of this long, drawn-out experiment in this thing we call infinite growth. So to me, it's like, well, what? There are limits on this planet. There are ecological limits. There's only so much we can grow. I mean, it's like Edward Abbey said something like it's the ideology of a cancer cell. It's the idea that you can have infinite growth on a finite planet. And so for me, I'm seeing limitations.
Sorry for interrupting you, but
no, you're fine.
I would like to distinguish between two points here. It is absolutely true that you cannot have infinite growth on an infinite planet, but that doesn't imply that growth has to imminently cease. Mm. I mean, they're just completely unrelated points. You know, there are certainly there's certainly some limit, but it's not clear at all to me that limit is imminent. You know, if we're talking about wild animals, I don't think that capitalism or modern society or whatever you want to call it really depends very much on wild animals. You know, you could have not necessarily a mass extinction, given what we know about how mass extinctions are caused, but you could lose tigers, pandas, koalas is the one that came up, even though it's not really, and we're not really, they're not going extinct. You could lose those, and it wouldn't affect us that much because they don't produce very much profit.
Right. Well, can I say this then? Okay. So the fact is not everything is a utility within capitalism. So for instance, you said something earlier, and I can't contend with this point. You're saying that farmland maybe has, you know, exploded and then maybe it receded, or, you know, it's grown or it's expanded and then it's receded. I can't argue whether that's true or not. The problem isn't that. The problem is that you have land that is converted into agriculture. Maybe they then are, okay, they're like, well, we're not going to do this anymore because they've actually expended the utility of the land itself and they have to leave it alone. And then it really takes a very long time for that land to be regenerated again, to become anything other than just some wasteland or some desert.
Well, it's not quite that bad. It's that it will go to about 70% if it's land that has been converted into agriculture and then converted back into forest, it will never get quite to the level that it was before. But it'll go quite a ways, you know, have about 70% of the biodiversity that you had before, which is, you know, it's diminished. Right. And I think we should be serious about that diminishment, but it's not a wasteland.
So the point you were making, you're saying that like pandas and all these other wildlife, they have no purpose under capitalism. And I think that's exactly the point, is that because it doesn't serve a purpose, it doesn't matter to us in the capitalist world. It doesn't affect us if the last rhino in Malaysia died, you know, or, you know, went extinct very recently. It doesn't really affect us that pandas are disappearing or koalas are disappearing or any of these other animals and other forms of wildlife are disappearing. And that's kind of the point here, which I'm trying to, I guess, say is that if it doesn't serve the utility of capital, then it's just, so what if it goes away? We'll replace that, you know, thing with something else, or we'll just sort of not even give a shit. We don't even care if it goes away. And I think that's like a really narrow-minded and kind of psychopathic way of looking at life on this planet. That's what I mean, is that capitalism reduces everything to one thing, which is if it doesn't serve capital, then it can either go away or whatever. And we'll move it out of the way. I mean, we'll develop that land or we won't, but it doesn't matter if those ecosystems disappear and are dramatically reduced. But the thing that I want to say is that we are organisms on this planet. We do have a habitat. We do rely on specific conditions to survive. We are very, very adaptable, as you pointed out. I mean, we're one of the only species that, at least I know of, that can live pretty much in any climate in the world and thrive. That's amazing. I mean, that's obviously indicates human beings.
At least of mammals, yes.
Of mammals, yes, exactly. I mean, we're not bacteria, right, or whatever. But I mean, you know, like as far as mammals go, absolutely, that's the case. That doesn't change the fact that there aren't limits. And I guess this is just my opinion, and this is based on my own assumptions about the data that I've read, that when you start to see such dramatic loss of wildlife and of insect populations, you're seeing the ocean currents are shifting. You see all these other dramatic changes, and they're happening within a very short period of time. And that's the key here. This is a very short time scale. I mean, we're seeing this within several generations of human beings. And that's why it's concerning. It's like we obviously have hit certain thresholds on the planet, and we're not stopping. We're not changing course. And in fact, we're even going harder in many cases. So that's the concerning thing here. So that's why when I look at the future, I'm like, well, if it took 50 years for us to get to this point to where we are now, well, what's it going to take to get to the next stage where, okay, well, then all these insects are gone now. All the pollinators have disappeared. You know, how long before the Amazon? I mean, there's this real threat right now. If we continue to deforest, or if the people in the Amazon, the Brazilians, I suppose, or other people down in South and Central America continue to burn back the forest, another 20%, they're expecting a dieback. I mean, that's just sort of an inevitable conclusion.
That's scientifically problematic. You know, there has been a mechanism that if it's more than, it's been identified as a potential mechanism that if there's more than 40%, the Amazon may begin to die back naturally. But it's, A, that's not unstoppable. You can have reforestation. You can even have reforestation done by humans. And these lower levels, you know, more than 20%, 25%, those are just entirely speculative. Yeah. You know, I went ahead and looked up this stuff when it was going on. And there was also this thing like, you know, the Amazon dies back. We're going to run out of oxygen. We won't be able to breathe.
That's actually not true. Yeah, that isn't true. Yeah, I agree.
It's a total misunderstanding of how oxygen gets into the atmosphere. And I'm glad he got that at least.
Yeah, I did. Absolutely.
Not to be
careful. Yeah, I mean, no, and that's what I mean. But I guess for me, like, let me ask you this. I mean, like, so let's say all this is overblown, right? Let's say we won't go extinct. I mean, let's say in 100 years, human beings will still be around. We'll still have something like civilization as we understand it to be. I mean, like, at what point to you would we have reached a point where it's completely untenable? Do you know what I mean? Like, at what point will we be like, okay, well,
I mean, you're talking about things that are probably thousands of years in the future or more. I mean, I really have as far as I can tell, human society reproduces itself based on the economy. It doesn't reproduce itself based on wild animals or forests. You know, those are important, but you can look at what we've done here in the U.S. and, you know, we rely on forests for lumber, and we cut down a whole bunch of forests. We eventually kind of stopped doing that, and we started replanting them, and we planted pine forests, which are lacking in biodiversity and all of the natural things that we would like to have, but they produce lumber. Very quickly. They grow very quickly, and we can chop those pine trees right down and, you know, get all the lumber we need. I mean, I don't see where the end could be. you know, it's there is going to be some sort of limit, but it's not clear to me what it is. And I'm almost convinced it's not imminent. You know, there are certain things that worry me as far as climate change goes. If you're talking about centuries in the future, there could be an anoxic ocean event, which starts to release hydrogen sulfide. But, you know, probably my favorite doomer, Peter Ward, says, he's a paleontologist who writes a lot about climate. He's an expert on mass extinctions. He says, you know, if worse comes to worse and the oceans start emitting hydrogen sulfide, we'll have gas masks. You know, there's nothing that can stop us, really. You know, there can be very, very horrible things in store in the future, but they're not in this century, and they probably won't kill us.
Okay, so I want to say one thing, and this totally is about me. I just want to say this because this speaks to my what you just said almost horrifies me more than us going extinct, because we'll push that shit as far as possible to the point where we're all walking around with fucking gas. Like, how shitty would it be to live in a world like that? I mean, we should all be dead at that point anyway. I mean, it's like, at what point is the limit? I mean, look, we may be able to finagle our way through any crisis. We may be able to geoengineer our way out of this. But at what point is it like, what the fuck are we doing, and what have we really done here? I mean, that's to me like the real thing. I mean, like, look, we may not go actually extinct. We may be able to, again, like, push our way through this for the next several centuries. But I mean, in a very real way, it'll be a planet that I don't think anybody should be alive on, almost. It's just so fucked.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you there.
Yeah.
I have a lot of sympathy for that. And to the extent that people who are advocating for climate advocates or environmentalists, I think that is a perfectly reasonable perspective to take.
Right.
Especially when you're talking about, you know, the we'll have gas masks scenario.
Right.
But the problem I have is when people say, you know, oh, this is going to lead to our collapse right away. You know, you have to do what I say or else you'll die.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem I have, because I think it's very unlikely to happen.
Okay. Well, I will say, like, I will say, though, that I agree in the sense that we have to be careful. And I know, JG, you kind of mentioned this with Ehrlich a little bit, some of the eco-fascist.
I wanted to circle back around to that real quickly, because I wanted to say, I don't get the impression that you're into the whole neo-Malthusian thing, or that even overpopulation necessarily factors in to all your work. I think you've talked about it a few times, but
yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, I think what I'm more concerned about now. I mean, look, I mean, Alex, you may be right, and if you are, I mean, look, I don't want this to happen. You know what I mean? I don't want people to go extinct. I actually like people quite a bit, and I wish we would get. You know, I want it to work out for us. I really do. I think partly what informs my work is this sense that if we act as if we don't have time left, then it just allows us to act in a way that I think actually may be liberatory. I know that sounds really peculiar, but actually having this view that, like, we may not have a lot of time left. What do you want to do in this time that you're here? And you know, how would you act if you knew you only had a few weeks left to live, kind of mentality. It does lend a certain presence. We have to be present in the moment, and it forces us to kind of acknowledge maybe some other things about ourselves that I think are important. But it can go in a very different direction. It can go in a direction where, as we talked about with ecofascism, this idea that it can actually reinforce some of the worst aspects of our culture, of our ideologies, of these so-called differences that exist between us that are socially constructed, socially engineered in many ways. Because I think that's what fascism ultimately is. It's a socially engineered division between people. It creates false hierarchies. And I think that's the real danger here, is why I have pushed back against some of the more Malthusian, I call it more of the anti-human or human-hating ideologies that I tend to see within Doomer circles. It's not prominent necessarily, but it's definitely present. And I push back against it because I think that that kind of rhetoric and that kind of logic does allow room for certain ideologies to make a certain kind of sense to people, including fascism. And I think whether we go extinct in the next few years or the next 100 years or whatever it is, I don't know. Those next few years in the face of really radical climate change is going to present more challenges with our societies and with our governments and with nation states than it is even ecologically and for many people, at least. I mean, many people aren't going to really care about the extinction of other species when they're running from the Gestapo, basically. You know what I mean? It's like, that's really, to me, one of the more frightening components of a lot of this. So I think climate disruption presents that as a real threat more than anything. Yeah.
JG, would you like to jump in?
Yeah, I wanted to ask both of you, since we sort of broached the topic of eco-fascism, are both of you familiar with, I believe he's a Finnish ecologist by the name of
Pentti Linkola?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know.
Yep.
I was curious if you could both comment on his sort of, because his sort of way of dealing with climate change is apocalyptic in and of itself. I mean, that's sort of the gas mask way of doing things. I mean, he basically advocates for a dictatorship where you would basically wipe out any sort of modern ways of living.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you mention him because I'm writing something right now, and I was researching. So I had an interview I did, and I actually transcribed part of the interview with a journalist named John Richardson. He wrote a piece that came out in New York Magazine last year titled Children of TED, where he spent a lot of time with these eco-extremists, like some really, like basically eco-fascists or eco eco-extremists, basically people that were inspired by Theodore Kaczynski. That's the term Children of TED, that's where it comes from, including this group down in Mexico called ITS, something like translates to individuals tending toward savagery or something. That's like
there's been a big fight in anarchist circles over that group.
Yes.
To interject, Ted Kaczynski is a Unabomber.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In case anybody didn't know.
Oh, yeah, no, that's good to point that out. Yes, the Unabomber, exactly. Yeah, so from 1970s, what was it? From sometime in the 70s until the mid-90s, he was on a bombing campaign. He was sending out homemade bombs from his little cabin in the backwoods of Montana, and the FBI couldn't find him, and they eventually did because he blackmailed, basically forced the authorities to say, hey, I'll stop bombing people if you publish my manifesto in a major publication unaltered. So they did, and that actually led to his arrest. I think it was New York Times, yeah.
He also threatened, I believe he also threatened Noam Chomsky, who you just interviewed.
Holy shit, fuck.
Yeah, he had planned to kill Noam Chomsky. I mean, Noam Chomsky has gotten a lot of death threats over the years.
I believe it, dude, and he doesn't deserve it, I gotta say. He doesn't deserve it.
Yeah, I don't agree with Chomsky, but he's actually had a lot of influence on me. I respect the guy a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, me too. Yeah, I love the man. He's been a big influence on me as well, but anyway, the point that I wanted to make, I'm sorry to kind of circle around back to this. I feel like I went on a long tangent here. The point of that is to say, while doing yesterday, it was exactly yesterday, I was reading this transcript that I had made of my interview with Richardson about his time with some of these eco-extremist types. He mentions Linkola. And I'm like, God damn it, I've heard at least 3-4 different times on this podcast, people have brought this guy up. Who the hell is Pentti Linkola? So I look up his website or whatever, whoever made the website for him. I assume he didn't make it himself. But
he's dead, yeah.
No, he's still alive. He's like 80.
He's still alive?
Alive. And the best part of it is he talks about how no one should have kids, but he himself is a breeder.
He is a breeder. What a term, man. Anybody that uses the term breeder that's such a disgusting
term. I was using it kind of like joking.
I know. I know you were. I get that. But I would never refer to anybody that way. But anyway, the point of this is just to say I was actually reading his ideas, and I watched a little bit of an interview that was translated into English. And I mean, this guy, I mean, he Yeah, I mean, he believes that we should close the borders. You know, speaking of the third world from earlier, talking about people dying in other places as a result of climate change, he's like, that's their own fault. You know, they're dying because they've squandered their own resources and they just deal with that on their own. He has no concern for any other group of people aside from his own, I guess, ethnic identity. You know, he's very much in this idea that we have to protect our own and, you know, screw everyone else. And we have to do everything we can to protect the natural world, at least that's how he frames it. And I mean, that includes radically deindustrializing. I mean, even stuff where he's talking about, you know, he talks about dictatorship a lot as well, like democracy is stupid. And we should have a dictatorship and we should be basically killing anybody. He was specifically talking about women. Like, women are the ones that produce children. We should definitely be targeting them for their ability to produce children. I mean, just really callous, cold, creepy.
You know, I have to be honest. When I first learned about Linkola, I was like, this has to be some type of performance art, because he was like talking about like we need to utilize the ideologies and tactics of National Socialism and Stalinism, and also we need to he said that we need bio warfare attacks on the urban centers, and I was like, he can't be serious.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, this stuff is crazy, but, you know, we were talking about Paul Ehrlich earlier. You know, this isn't well known, but Paul Ehrlich had a lot of influence, and there were millions of women around the world in this population scare who were sterilized. I mean, you can't entirely blame Ehrlich for this, but he was certainly the most prominent promoter of these ideas. And so there isn't that much air between Ehrlich and Linkola. They're very similar ideas, and I think that they'll have very similar consequences. I do think that the environmental movement has moved beyond this kind of population obsession, and it's really the domain of rightists like Linkola and Nick Land and all those kind of people now. But,
yes,
you know, this is the risk of taking these ideas and just pushing them to their limits. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, not just, you know, the one child policy or whatever, that people were really sterilized because people in India and Brazil and other places, because they were worried that the population was going to go out of control and it was going to wreak environmental consequences. And I think if there is actually a, you know, it makes sense. You know, I am not surprised that there are people like Linkola, because I think that these kind of limits ideas are really very conservative ideas. I'm not necessarily opposed to conservatism if it's reasoned and in its proper place, but I think that it can absolutely lead to some very horrific, you know, applications.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, again, like it has to be I think it has to be fit within like when I think of like ecology, we think of how to, you know, respect the ecological systems and fit within them. There is this unfortunate thing where people will kind of project or put these sort of ideological overlays over this. So they are reinforcing certain things. Certain ideas get reinforced in these states of crisis, I think. And so, yeah, you know, you get people like Linkola, and this is what scares me, is he's a fringe character for sure. He's very fringe. But I think, as, again, me speaking a bit apocalyptically, but I think if we are going to, in fact, see more refugees spilling over borders as a result of climate disruption, people are going to hold on to their identities and cling on to them even more. So if people are kind of racist now, they're going to be even more racist when they're dealing with the fact that there's refugees coming across the border, you know? It's like the already sort of loosely held beliefs will become more tightly held as people start to experience more rapid change in their environment, and they'll feel all the more entitled to their comforts and to their way of life. So I think for me, what I'm trying to get people on is find other people who don't want to do this. They don't believe in this. They want to have a better world. They want to live with other people in a more peaceful way, overcome a lot of these deep-seated ideologies that we may have, and begin to build communities of resilience right now before the shit really does hit the fan and we can actually build places where we can have refugees come and they won't be treated like shit and thrown into concentration camps. Like, that needs to start happening.
I would add to that, we also have to be, you know, this is one area where I might depart from the people who often express the kind of views I've been expressing here. We have to be, you know, we have to have climate financing. You know, if we're going to get climate, if we're going to get emissions under control, and if we're going to make these countries that are going to be more impacted resilient, there has to be some sort of wealth transfer between the industrialized countries that are responsible for the historical climate change, you know, up to 1C, you know, where it's very heavily, with very disproportionate in favor of Europe and the United States and Russia, into these much poorer countries like China and India that have industrialized lately. Mm. And, you know, if these places are going to be livable places in the 21st century, then there has to be some sort of, there has to be a transfer. You know, I get into this with people sometimes that are more on my side, and I think this is just non-negotiable. It's just, it's something we have to do to make sure that, you know, they can get both, they can, you know, adopt renewables or nuclear or whatever we're going to do to reduce carbon emissions and get off fossil fuels, and just to adapt. And I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Do you mm-hmm. do you believe the carbon tax then is enough to deal with this?
You know, I think the carbon tax is, it has a problem in that it's a market-based mechanism. And there's just this idea that if we use these market-based mechanisms, that will solve everything. And I don't think so. You know, I think that you can have a carbon tax and the markets will just find a way to get around it. You know, if you're really going to do this, you are going to have a very state-based program. I don't, you know, maybe, you know, I'm not a runaway statist, but I don't see any other way to do it, to be honest. Like, you're going to have a massive build-out of nuclear and renewables and all the rest. And you're going to have to transition industries to that are emitting a lot of carbon now that are not electric, like steel, cement, fertilizer production. Those are all going to have to be nationalized, and there's going to have to be a massive investment in research to get those, you know, to find ways to reduce those emissions. I don't see any other way. Not if you want to get these very ambitious climate goals that I think we're going to blow past. But you have to do that. I don't see any other way.
Mm.
Just two more things, if we could get into it real quickly here. Both of you saw the tiff that Vladimir Putin had with Greta Thunberg recently.
I'm not as familiar with it. Yeah, I'm not very familiar with it.
Yeah, I think he said something like, "Oh, you know, she has a, you know, I respect her speech, but she doesn't quite get it."
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he said she's a sincere and kind girl, but she doesn't quite get it. I'm not necessarily agreeing with Putin on that, but it did get me to thinking about, if we have countries that are committed to building themselves up within an industrialized system, you know, it's going to be really hard telling them you have to cut the carbon emissions. Maybe that's not what he was referring to, but it led me down that path of thinking about that. And I just wanted both of you to be able to sort of comment on that issue, because I think a lot of developing nations aren't going to they're not going to cut carbon emissions. They're going to keep developing in the way that they are developing now, and you know, you can't really tell them otherwise. I mean, and there's that may be justifiable on their part.
Well, I think it depends on the country. You know, I actually saw a poll recently, which was basically, they asked a bunch of countries how responsible they were for carbon emissions, and, you know, how, I think, basically, well, that's the important point, how responsible they were for carbon emissions. If you look at China, only 25% of them think they are a major carbon emitter, or that they have to do anything about it. If you look at India, which is actually much lower than China, It's more like 75%. And in fact, you know, they think that both of those countries actually think that it's going to, you know, end humanity. You know, it's kind of, it's very interesting. And I think it very much depends on the country. It depends on culture. It depends on politics. And I think that some countries are going to be more committed than others. I think China is really going to have to be, you know, brought to heel, basically, by the agreements of other countries. You know, that's the main barrier to getting the Paris Accord and so on was getting China on board. And the Paris Accord is already not enough. And the only way I really see this stuff working is what I said before, is we're going to have to finance it. The richer countries, which, you know, honestly probably includes China, or at least soon will, are going to have to finance this stuff. We're going to have to do sustainable development financed by the richer countries. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that. And so I'm, you know, Patrick said before, you know, he thought that my vision was maybe worse than his. And maybe it is. You know, I consider myself a pessimist, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Patrick, you can respond too.
Well, I think, I don't know. I don't really have a way to say whether it's, I mean, look, I get it. If people are like living in abject poverty, then they want something better. And I wouldn't want to deny that of anybody. I get it. Like, absolutely.
That's sort
like,
of what I was getting at. You stated it much better than I did. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I get right. it. Like, it's like so obvious. Like, why would I say no to that? But it's like, I think for me, it's like, you know, Alex, you mentioned like sustainable energy and all this, and this might be another hour long thing, and I don't necessarily want to get into it, but the idea that there is such a thing as green technologies or sustainability within the technologies that we're discussing, usually that means some combination of solar powers, wind turbines,
carbon capture.
Yeah,
there's something I'm hearing carbon, about more.
Yep, carbon capture.
Yeah, negative
storage.
Emissions technologies. Yeah, all that.
Yeah, and I think to me that's just, again, that's not gonna, it's not actually sustainable. So there's that first thing. I mean, there's always going to be costs that come with these technologies. Some maybe we could even maybe argue, I can't maybe necessarily based on what I know right now, but there are really, really terrible costs that come with the extraction required to produce these technologies. And again, it kind of still does this thing where certain places are viewed as sacrifice zones, as they're called, places where you can extract certain types of minerals and whatnot so that you can, you know, make solar panels and wind turbines and batteries and all the things that are required. I mean, so it's really a tough bind. We're going to have to really, really reimagine how we live on this planet. And it's not going to be using any sort of methods that are being proposed right now with carbon taxes or carbon credits or industrialization of any kind. Now, I'm not saying I know the answer to that. I want to be very, you know, I don't know. And I also want to be aware that it's not for me to tell groups of people that they can't work towards a better future or a better living situation for themselves. I get that. But I also just want to be very critical of some of the ways in which we frame the solutions, supposedly, to these crises that we're in the midst of right now. It's I don't have an answer for that, but I will say that we need to start asking maybe different questions. And I don't know necessarily what they are, but certainly within the framework that we have currently, I don't think we'll ask the right questions. I don't think it'll be enough. Yeah. That's not a satisfying spiel, but there you go.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
I wouldn't exaggerate how much the extraction actually emits carbon. I mean, it is true that, say, steel production and so on emit carbon, or uranium mining emits a little bit, but it's nowhere near what fossil fuels are. Just as an aside.
Yeah, but again, I don't care if it takes a lot of fossil fuels or not or emissions to do the extraction. It's the actual extraction itself. I mean, you look at lithium mines, you look at cobalt mines, you look at where these are happening. You also look at any of that. I mean, it's atrocious. And then the way the
whole system. Well, it depends where it is, isn't it? I mean, if you look at mining in Australia, those people get paid big bucks. And, they're not your, stereotypical coal miner with black lung and whatever.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But again, the act itself, the mining itself, it doesn't matter if it's in Australia or if it's in Bolivia or if it's in somewhere in Western or wherever in Africa, the act itself is going to be exploitive, whether it's of human life or whether it's of the earth itself. And that's how I look at things. Like, I'm going to just be very clear. Like, when you mine into the earth and extract it on that level, you're producing all kinds of toxic waste. That leaches into the water, that leaches into the soil. Like, that's, again, they call it a sacrifice zone for a reason. That place is going to be completely, it's only going to serve one purpose. And once it's done, there's nothing else you can really do with that land for however many, I don't even know how many generations or hundreds or thousands of years before it can even become anything other than a wasteland, a toxic wasteland. So I mean, what I mean.
This is all really, dependent. I mean, if you're talking, there's a lot of mining that goes on in the United States, mm-hmm. and we are not just producing an endless toxic wasteland. I mean, as far as that is happening, it's coming from fossil fuels, coming mm-hmm. from fracking, it's coming from coal mining, it's coming from oil extraction, most of all, which fracking is involved with. I think that if you're talking, and actually I would, I'm a big nuclear advocate here. You don't need very much uranium to make to run a nuclear plant. As far as energy density goes, it's the most energy dense fuel. You have to do the least amount of mining. And in fact, it can even be extracted from seawater. I'm not sure if that will be, that's not economical now. I'm not sure if it will ever be economical, but it's possible. And the only reason it's even imaginably economical is because of that energy density. And you could, at least conceivably supply energy that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, conceivably you could. And I don't know how much longer I would want to, because we could, there's like 50 rabbit holes that we could all go down when we talk about this.
Yeah, that's the problem with this. As I said in my earlier, we can talk about this forever.
Yeah, I mean, like with nuclear, for instance, I'm not an advocate for nuclear. So that's, again, that could turn into a whole other discussion. I think the way that I'm framing it does come from a certain perspective that has to be sort of, it's a philosophical question ultimately, and also comes down to values. I've realized more and more this discussion comes down to our values more than anything. But anyway,
well,
JG,
I was going to add in there, and then we'll start to wrap up. I think a lot of what I see with climate change activists, I think there's this sort of side issue that drives a lot of it. I would assume that you'll not take issue with this, but I would say that you are very critical of consumerism and sort of technology, especially in this age of social media, which often feels like it's only made us more antisocial. I guess what I'm getting at is, I think something that also drives people that are interested in the environment is this sense that the current system is making us more and more atomized and sort of alienated, which I'm very sympathetic to that view. And I think
as
maybe... Right. Well, I was going to say, I think a lot of the debate around these things is also driven by that sort of philosophical question of, is any of this really making us happier? I notice a lot of people that are extremely online are already complaining about, the holidays. And I always say to them, I'm like, you can go outside and go to a Food Not Bombs place and help out the homeless. It'll probably make you much happier. I think a lot of this has to do with how society seems to, at times, it feels like we're moving in a more and more antisocial or atomized direction.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I completely agree with you. And look, I'm like, when it comes to all these subjects, I have to be very clear that I would define myself as a hypocrite in many ways. I mean, I am the extremely online, if you want to use that term. I am online too much, and I, you know what I mean? Like, it's, it's like I can be as critical of these things as I want. Doesn't change the fact that I flew a plane to get to where I am right now. Doesn't change the fact that I drive a car. Doesn't change the fact that I consume and I throw away plastic and I'm, you know, I'm using a computer to talk to you. You know, all of us are complicit. All of us are a part of it. And you know, I don't know how to always reconcile these contradictions in my life. And I mean, think that's
an individual actor can't. Well, I personally believe this. I don't think an individual actor can change the world. I'm very against great man theory. I think everything is driven much more socially than that.
I agree completely. So when it comes to any of these massive changes that I would bank on or hope for, yeah, it's going to come from a very collective effort. And I think our system tends to produce individualized responses to what is ultimately what I think ultimately is required is a collective response. That's the only way that we're going to really address any of these things that we've talked about up to this point. And so, yeah, I just want to be clear, like I can be very critical of things. And I think this discussion about extinction or whatever, it's all very abstract in many ways. It's often very abstracted. And so I think for me, regardless of whether it happens or not, we do need to really reassess our position in this time we're in, that the planet that we're all a part of. I really do think that that needs to be addressed on some fundamental level in one way or the other. And I do think framing it within a certain way can either lead us towards despair and inaction, or it can lead us towards some sort of liberatory action. And I think that that line between those two is actually quite hard to know where that's at. It's quite blurry and vague, and it's something I've tried my own very, I try to say it humbly, but I don't know, but I try my best to sort of navigate that line in my own way. And that's why I have the positions that I do, and that's why I talk the way that I do about them. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it adds to what you had to say as well about how, you know, the underlying problem here is something like how society is producing atomization. I'm a big fan of Emile Durkheim, the one of the three classical founders of sociology. He wrote about anomie, and he diagnosed anomie as the malady of infinite desires. And I think this kind of ties in with the whole ecological issue, which is that just changing society and getting more is not going to be enough. It is unsustainable, not, I believe, for ecological reasons, but for societal reasons. And I think that all this anxiety over the end of the world, basically, is kind of a symptom of that. What we're facing here, and what the origin of all of these fears is not really that we're going to all die because of climate change or the loss of biodiversity or whatever else. It's because that the way we're living is not right. There is a serious problem and we've gotten off track. And, you know, I have some ideas on how we might resolve that. It would be, you know, I'm a big fan of Earl Ellis, who does write about ecology, but not quite in the way that that you would hear from climate activists, say. His ideas are more like we have to accept that we are the dominant species on Earth, and we have to come to terms with that and the responsibility that that gives us. And we're going to have to find a way to balance these concerns that we have for our own well-being, for the well-being of people who are living in less developed countries, who are looking for a better life, for an escape from a dead end, along with the concerns of the rest of nature, for other species or wild places and so on. And, you know, I think if there's any kind of positive resolution that's going to come out of this, it's going to come out of something like that.
Just to tie this all up into a little bow, you know, I want to mention a documentary real quickly. Have either of you seen the documentary Collapse, or are you familiar with it?
Yes. I have.
Maybe. Is that the one that starts out with in the seed repository in Norway?
No. It's a documentary about Michael J. Rupert, who was pretty big in the early 9/11 truther scene, the peak oil scene, and he was very interested in environmentalism. And he got a few things right. He was right about stuff related to Wall Street and financial corruption. So I'll give him that. But the documentary is very interesting because it's basically just a long form interview with him, and he's of the opinion that collapse is imminent. And it was interesting because the interviewer said to him at one point, "So you're saying this is inevitable?" And he says, "Yes." And, you know, the guy says, the interviewer says, "Well, what about technology?" "Well, no. Technology isn't going to fix the problem." And I think, you know, it's an interesting documentary because, you know, Rupert is sort of the skeptic of anything that is thrown at him. But whether you come down on the side of technology will save us, or this will save us, or that will save us, or you come on the side of no, none of that's going to save us, it really is an open question at the end of the day. You know, I don't really know if technology will save us. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I think a lot of these questions are still open-ended. I don't know what both of you think of that.
Yeah.
Well, there's this skepticism in a lot of environmental discourse of what's sometimes called a techno-fix, which is basically what you said. Oh, you know, technology will save us. But, you know, I kind of view it differently. You know, you don't need some sort of magical technology coming in. Oh, there's a coyote. Watching a coyote run across somebody's yard. It's not that technology needs to create some miracle. You can pretty much rely on technologies that have been going on with incremental progress for decades or a century. You know, and agricultural yields have been going up since basically the Haber-Bosch process came into existence, and we had fertilizer. You know, there's something like 100 to 300% of what they used to be back in 1920. And I'm not necessarily convinced of all of the kind of techno-utopian ideas, like, you know, we're going to suck carbon out of the atmosphere, we're going to find ways to get around all of these carbon emissions. But I think that what we have is already enough to sustain us for the foreseeable future. Certainly for my lifetime, if I have any children, probably for their lifetime. I think it, to the extent that there are serious challenges to the life of humanity on Earth, it's going to come in the next centuries to millennia. You know, we're just too good. You know, you don't have to have big techno fixes that are going to solve all of the problem.
Well, that's
to just
what
keep us continuing.
Yeah. Well, that's what was posed to Rupert. You know, well, technology will incrementally just keep getting better, and it will find a way to get through this. What I'm saying though is, I mean, I can't say that Rupert's right, and I really can't say the other side is right. I mean, to me, all of this ends up, we're going down a speculative rabbit hole in a lot of ways. I mean, it's very possible that historically speaking, we've seen it through things like the Black Plague. Maybe we'll see it through this. On the other hand, I also don't know, I can't disprove what Rupert was saying or what these doomers are saying. I mean, it's sort of...
Do you have any reason to believe it's true? Like, why would it happen now? You know, it can never be disproved. There are always going to be people that say the world is...
It's unfalsifiable, yeah.
I mean, it's not disprovable, and I mean, and it's worth taking seriously. I don't dismiss doomers. We should always listen to the reasons that the world might come to an end abruptly, but we shouldn't allow it to structure our lives.
Right.
We shouldn't allow it to structure our ideologies, and we shouldn't allow it to structure how we do things in the current day. I mean, it's, you can always say, oh, you know, there's no, you know, this is just going to stop now. But I don't see any reason it will stop. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, I think Patrick has raised some reasons why it might not be. You know, it's not necessarily good. I'm not, I consider myself a pessimist.
No, I get that. I guess what I'm saying is, you can't prove a negative, but your point's well taken as well of, you know, well, what reason do we have to believe otherwise? Why should we believe this sort of doomer perspective? To me, I'm sort of a, I question both sides a lot. But Patrick, do you have any comment? And I'll give you guys any, if you guys both have final comments to make in regards to this whole discussion. Patrick, if you want to chime in.
I don't know if I have any final thoughts. I would just say that, you know, we'll see. I don't know. I mean, I again, this is a matter of values. I really do think it does come down to values, and a matter of whether if we can, in fact, negotiate our way through this crisis that I think we're in the midst of and squeeze a few more centuries out of it. I think the costs of doing that are far worse than what's coming anyway. Do you know what I mean? That's, again, that's a philosophical position, or that's a sort of almost a spiritual position that I've taken. So when it comes to these questions of whether or not it's happening, there are a lot of assumptions that I'm totally aware of that I have. And I think many people that are in the doomer community have as well. And so I think it's good to have these discussions. You know, we're not yelling at each other. There's not this like massive fight happening. We're able to listen to each other. And I think that's good. And if we can keep that going as long as possible, then at least I think we're doing something right, I think, ultimately. But yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything else to say. I think, I do think that the science is difficult to kind of decipher a bit sometimes. I think that you could come to the conclusions that I've had. You could also come to the conclusions that Alex has. Science kind of proves both points, and that's kind of the mind fuck here. So we need to kind of, it does truly, I know maybe this seems like a cop out, and I get if it does, but it really does come down to what you value. And so, yeah, that's really my final point. I guess if I could make any final point, that would be what I would say.
And Alexander, do you have anything you want to say on a final note?
Yes. I would encourage people to read the latest SR15 report from the IPCC. And there's going to be another report coming out, I believe, in, is it 2021 or 2022, which is going to be the assessment report, number 6. And I would encourage people to read that if you want to know what's really going to happen with climate change, and you'll get the overview of thousands and thousands of scientists working on the greatest research project in human history to find out what's actually going to happen with climate change. But I would also like to temper that with an acknowledgement that there, you know, which has come up through this, that there is a bigger problem. We can't assume that everything is going to turn out okay just because climate isn't going to kill us. There are, you know, society is just, does seem to be, at least subjectively, going out of control. There's too much, everything. You know, we've gotten locked into this idea of infinite progress. And that's that. More than the environment is unsustainable. We have to find a new way to organize our lives and to be able to live in an organized society. And climate, I hope, you know, to be optimistic, I would hope that could encourage some sort of rethinking of how we do things. But at the end of the day, you know, it seems to me that we're headed down the wrong path, and I don't see any very good ways out of it.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Patrick Farnsworth of Last Born in the Wilderness and Alexander Miller, for coming on Parallax Views. I think it was a good discussion.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. Let me know what you thought of the great debate on climate doomerism between Alexander Miller and Patrick Farnsworth of the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. For my Patreon supporters, I've just archived the first 20 classic episodes of Parallax Views and will be archiving more of those episodes intermittently. I don't like putting much behind a paywall, but if I want to keep providing you with great content, I am going to have to archive some of the older shows, which, in my view, remain relatively timeless for the most part. Also, my pal Casey, co-host of the Parallax Views Current Events podcast, The Week That Was, is, after a trip to Europe, alive and well. We are back in contact and should be recording a new episode of The Week That Was tomorrow evening. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.